Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Manning.
Welcome, everyone, to the fifth panel of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's Global Dialogue Series for 2020 and 2021. I'm Paul Hanley. I'm the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, and I'm glad to be joined by colleagues and friends today, Dr. Rosa Belfour and Dr. Cui-Hung Zhen, to discuss how the European Union is navigating rising tensions between China and the United States. For those of you who are unfamiliar with our Carnegie Global Dialogue Series, this is the ninth year that we have been hosting this series of events. It consists basically of a series of panel discussions examining China's evolving foreign policy and international role from the perspective of Carnegie scholars across the globe. Carnegie has six global centers. This panel is the fifth and last panel of the Carnegie Global Dialogue Series for this academic year. Our last four discussions have focused on US-China, China-India, China-Russia, China-Middle East, and today, of course, China-EU. And for anyone who wants to go rewatch this discussion or watch any of our previous discussions, you can see the replays on the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's China in the World podcast site. The podcast is a series of discussions that I host with Chinese and international experts. We have recorded over 150 episodes, and so in addition to going back and watching our Carnegie Global Dialogue series, you'll see a number of conversations there that you might be interested in. Turning to today's discussion, I'd like to start by introducing our distinguished experts, Dr. Rosa Belfour and Dr. Cui-Hung Zhen. Rosa is coming in this morning from Brussels, Belgium, where she is the director of the Carnegie Europe Center. So a colleague of mine at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, my counterpart there in Brussels. Her fields of expertise include European politics and institutions, foreign policy and security policy. In addition to her role with Carnegie, she's a member of the Steering Committee of Women in International Security, Brussels, and she's an associate fellow at London School of Economics Ideas, the foreign policy think tank there. She was awarded a fellowship on the Europe's Futures Program at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna in 2018 and 2019, and earlier this year became an honorary patron of the University Association for Contemporary European Studies. Delighted to host Rosa this morning. Thank you for joining us. And in Beijing, China, we have Dr. Cui-Hung Zhen, who has participated in our Carnegie Global Dialogue series in years past. So we're delighted to have him back with us. Dr. Cui is the director of the Department of European Studies at the China Institute for International Studies, well-known think tank in Beijing. In 2016, Dr. Cui participated in our third annual Carnegie Global Dialogue Series. He's participated in other events at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. He's an expert on European and Chinese diplomacy, and he's been working at his institute since 1998. He also serves as the director at the Chinese Association for European Studies. He's the executive director of the Center for European Studies of the China Foundation for International Studies, and he's the director at the China Economic and Social Council. I don't think we could find two better experts to have our discussion this morning. Today's discussion will focus, and thank you, Dr. Cui, for joining us. Today's discussion will focus on the trilateral dynamics between the European Union, China, and the United States. There's been recently major shifts in the EU's relations with both China and the United States. We'll talk about both this morning. In 2020, China overtook the United States to become Europe's largest trading partner, and economic ties between China and the EU show no sign of abating as Brussels and Beijing signed the long-awaited Comprehensive Agreement on on investment in December of last year. Growth and economic ties, however, have accelerated at a time where there are political frictions, and those political frictions seem to be sharpening. In March, the EU joined Canada, the UK, and the United States in sanctioning several Chinese officials, as well as one Chinese SOE, for alleged human rights abuses in Xinjiang. And China responded very quickly with sanctions of its own, targeting 10 individuals and four organizations within the EU. As a result, last week, the EU Parliament voted overwhelmingly to freeze the comprehensive agreement on investment. On the opposite side of the globe, transatlantic ties have begun to regain some of the ground that was lost over the past 4 years during the Trump administration. President Biden has recommitted to working with partners in the EU to address a range of issues, including climate change, nonproliferation, global governance, and indeed on issues related to the challenges that we face with China. And the administration has been incredibly proactive in reaching out and finding common ground with Brussels and individual European nations. But there still remain concerns in Brussels about whether the U.S. over the long term will be a reliable partner, given the uncertainties in transatlantic ties over the past 4 years. And so to explore these shifting trends, which I've very briefly outlined, and to discuss EU's shifting relations with China and the United States, we're very fortunate to have with us Rosa Balfour and Dr. Cui-Hung Jen. So let's begin with the European perspective, Rosa. I wanted to first start out with the new Biden administration coming into office in January. You know, how effective has the Biden, in your view, how effective has the administration been at beginning the process of repairing the transatlantic ties? You wrote an article for Carnegie in April where you noted that Brussels has welcomed the Biden administration's return to multilateralism, Brussels has welcomed the United States rejoining the Paris Accords, rejoining the WHO, the World Health Organization, and restarting talks on the Iran nuclear deal. But you also note that the EU is taking a bit of a wait and see approach, looking for deeds from the new administration more than words. So I think the way your article talked about it. What does the administration need to do to convince the EU that the United States is back, and what more needs to be done? What challenges remain in the way of repairing the transatlantic ties?
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you for inviting me to join you. I'm delighted to be with you, and I hope next year we'll be in person rather than virtually. Indeed, I think we should not underestimate the degree to which the Trump years were a big shock for Europeans. And the shadow is always there in the background that come 2024, there might be a return of Trumpism in one form or another, and that the EU will be left out in the cold again. And this means that the EU is somewhat more cautious in embracing acritically US positions, US demands, which also means that while the rhetoric and the language and the messaging used by the Biden administration, which I personally think represents a significant shift even by comparison to previous administrations that were benign towards Europe. Both Blinken and Biden have been going out of their way to say they want to listen to what partners have to say. And this is music to the ears of Europeans. They want their voice heard and their opinions taken into account, because only that way the US will understand the strategic dilemmas that Europe finds itself in with respect to relationships with other countries, including, China. But the proof will be in the pudding, and it really will depend on the degree to which the US and the EU will cooperate. Just to give one example, when the US announced unilaterally without prior consultation that it intended to drop the patent with regard to COVID vaccines, Europeans did not appreciate that. It's not just because they have a different position as to what is most effective to help solve the global coronavirus pandemic, but it's also that they were not consulted prior to this announcement. And that's really where a lot of sensitivities go within the EU. It's, you know, the unilateralism of the past 4 years, and to what degree is that being overcome? Having said this, the EU and the US are engaging in several conversations, some of which are quite practical, for instance, looking at trade or corporate taxation. These processes will continue and are likely to smoothen out many of the differences, the transatlantic differences. And then, of course, in a couple of weeks' time, we'll have all the big events taking place in Europe, the NATO summit, the EU-US summit, several bilateral visits on the margins of this. And that will really give us an indication of where things are going. With respect to China, and I think perhaps let's just focus on this somewhat, I think there are two issues. The first is that the EU it's been jerked into a greater awareness about the type of challenges that and opportunities that China poses to Europe. So we have come from a decade or more in which Europe viewed China principally through business lens as a large, you know, great economic opportunities. This was driven by the belief that China would be socialized into the international system, into the multilateral system, which was in the interests of the EU. Then with the Trump years, Trump has been posing black and white questions, either with us or without us. That is something the EU does not appreciate. We have precedents of this, for instance, 2003 with Iraq. The EU prefers a much more nuanced position, but it also raised awareness of a certain dimension of the challenges that China poses to Europe. And so Europe has been changing its policy basically since 2019. So where do things stand now? The first point is the degree to which the US is willing to accept that the EU is likely to always have a nuanced policy towards China and any other actor, and that it's not going to embrace black and white language about international relations. It does not see geopolitics in terms of great power rivalry. That's not how the EU plots itself on the global map. So that is the first point. The second, however, is that we're seeing greater awareness of the several challenges that China is bringing about, and the challenges that the Trump years brought about. And both these are pushing the EU in a direction which is focusing a bit more intensely on what are its core strategic interests, what can it achieve alone, there's a whole new debate on Europe's strategic autonomy. And in this framework, under this rubric, there's several developments that are taking place, and we can talk about them further if you want, which will have implications both for US-EU relations, but also for EU-China relations.
Well, thank you for that excellent scene setter, which is going to be really helpful. I do want to come back to strategic autonomy as well. But, you know, your points on, you know, the 4 years of the Trump administration, big shock to Europe. And, you know, there's still a shadow hanging. And as you said, the EU is looking for proof will be in the pudding. And so in a sense, this is an important period for transatlantic ties, because anything that looks like the language, the rhetoric isn't matched by the deeds will be highlighted, will be magnified. And so this is an important period. Your points on China are critical. The more nuanced views in looking at China perhaps than the United States, although I don't expect the Biden team to use the same approach that the Trump administration used. You're either with us or you're without us. I think this administration recognizes that countries and regions around the world have interests with regard to China, but there are also some challenges that they want to deal with. And so I hope that aspect of things will be much better in the Biden administration than we saw in the Trump administration, because as you said, this black and white language doesn't really work in the European context. And then, of course, your point about challenges, not just from China, but also over the last 4 years from the United States. And that brings up the question about, as you said, what are Europe's core strategic interests and this notion of strategic autonomy. So terrific scene setter. And with this, I want to turn to Dr. Tsui, and I want to sort of get your perspective on both the warming transatlantic ties between the United States and the EU from a Chinese perspective. How do you see those? And then, you know, looking, of course, at the current state of the China-EU relationship. You know, China's had has long upheld the China-EU relationship as a model of a stable and mutually beneficial relationship. But as in recent months, as I mentioned before, there appear to be some growing uncertainties. You remarked in a recent interview with the Global Times that the EU is following in the footsteps of the United States by putting pressure on China. And is this, in your view, is this what's happening? Are these the dynamics that the US is pressuring the EU? Or is this something that has come about over the last 4 years and a bit of a reevaluation? Rosa mentioned that since 2019, the EU has had shifting views on China. And of course, the U.S.-China strategic outlook, which came out and called China a economic competitor and a systemic rival in advancing alternative forms of global governance. How much of this is because of pressure from the United States? How much of this is simply the EU taking its own interests at heart and coming up with its own analysis? So I'd be interested in your perspective both on transatlantic ties, but also China-EU ties.
Okay, thank you, Paul, and especially for Carnegie Tsinghua Center and for this opportunity, and also this very big question. I'm trying to give you my point. I think firstly, regarding to this perspective from mine about this transatlantic relations, especially since the Biden administration took the power. I think, according to my understanding, that now, undoubtedly, because of the change of the approaches and also even the doctrine from Biden administration comparing with Trump administration, so at the first time we can find a very active reaction from the European side, and even at this moment, I think it's a little bit different from history that. The European side tried to get some more positive posture in this transatlantic relations, because I think that still for European countries, for European Union, they do have the, some suspicion for this maybe the sustainable Biden administration's policy towards Europe. If we look at the, the political resources for Biden administration, and especially still a lot of supporters or a lot of the popularity of Trump's policy towards Europe in United States. So I think now this time, European side tried to get some a little bit more equal partnership with the United States. If we look at this new agenda for transatlantic partnership issued by European Union, and also emphasize of the some European leaders on so-called strategic autonomy and some other. But of course, I think now so far, they did, I think, a good job for United States and the European side to have some more coordination, especially in a political area. If we look at this some more announcement or declaration about the so-called coordination of venue or even some more maybe political coordination on so-called allies of democracy and some other. Of course, another I think so far achievement for this coordination between United States and the European Union is they try to coordinate the policies on China and also on Russia. But of course, so far, it's just, I think, the first round for this coordination between two sides. But now, for this, cooperation or coordination between European side and the United States, still, there are a lot of, test cases. For example, how could they deal with their own problem, including, as we know so far, the economic and the trade issue? Not yet. I think this time, especially the forthcoming summit between US and the European Union, would be a good opportunity for us to test if they have their own, winning, especially from the American side, to deal with some difficult issue. And also regarding to some other, like Nord Stream 2, and also Iran nuclear deal. All of these issues still are on the table. So I think that would be the real, cases to test if there is a real, as we understand, a kind of repair of the transatlantic relations and also rebuild of transatlantic relations. Regarding to this question you mentioned about China and the EU, I agree with Madam Rosa that it started from this, 2019, especially the strategic document issued by European Union, tried to change this definition of its relations with China with a kind of multifaceted description of China, including the partner, a competitor, and a rival. I think still now, from China's perspective, especially from an official stand, China will not accept this kind of change of the mindset of European side. Still, even yesterday, the Minister Wang still tried to change the mindset of European side by pointing out that there is only single, definition about the China-EU relation is a comprehensive strategic partnership. I think it shows a lot of the difference between the mindset between China and the EU on this kind of relations. For China, always China tried to get a more positive framework for its relations with the European side, especially in the background of the China-US competition. But of course, I think for European side that on one hand, European side tried to give some more pressure to China, especially to get some more sustainable benefits, not only for economic cooperation and the market in China, and also try to get some more, leverage towards China, especially when China become, powerful and powerful, always European side try to get some more instrument to have some more influence to China. Just like what happened recently, as Paul mentioned that this exchange of, sanctions in human rights issue, I think it gives a more complicated situation now for China and EU is, on one hand, they do have a lot of the common interests in economic and trade. If we look at the CAI, CAI means that still both two sides realized that there are a lot of potential for cooperation. But at the same time, in a political and human rights issue, and especially from a European side tried to find out more, maybe a powerful instrument to impose more impact or influence to China. Once China getting, powerful and powerful. So I think now the question for China and the EU, especially from China's perspective, is how could both two sides to get a kind of a balance between two different mindsets? I mean, for China, always China stressed the importance of having a more positive framework But at the same time, from European side, always try to get a balance, a balancing framework for these relations. But now the question for European side is, European Union try to have this balancing, and in different areas we do have a different logic to deal with. But the recent case for this human rights sanction and the CAI, especially the European Parliament, stop its process to ratificate the CAI, give a very, very big lesson to European side is European side should not manage it, very well, especially how could the European Union institution, I mean, for the Council, for the Commission, to deal with this challenge from the European Parliament. So once it happened like this way, I don't think that, there will be a good situation for European side to manage its relations with China. But of course, recently, I think, especially from China's side, it tried to get some more positive, interaction with some member states of the European Union. So I think now, perhaps, if we try to have some more optimistic, perspective on China-Europe relations, perhaps that firstly, China will try to find out a more panorama, vision, not only for European Parliament, just for some single member states, and also China try to get some more, multi-level engagement with the European side. And also at the same time, China also try to find the more, very special driving force for its relations with the European side, not always get some influence from relations between China and the United States. So I should stop here.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cui. I want to turn to the investment agreement, but before I do that, I want to give Rosa an opportunity maybe to respond to some of what you said regarding this. You know, China is looking for a more positive engagement with the EU, more balance. And I hear, Dr. Cui, some concern that you're expressing by what you see as a new revitalized EU approach may not bring that, as I understand it. But let me ask Rosa if she wants to respond to anything that you said.
Yeah, thank you very much, Paul. I do, when you sent out a rather big question, can the EU navigate through this? And I think some of the remarks also go in the degree to which the EU is actually capable of designing a policy to deal with US-China rivalry and Europe's role therein. So I thought maybe the best way to think about this is actually to deconstruct the EU, because it's a complex entity, and just look at the areas where the EU, how issues are evolving in several areas which are of relevance to relations with China. And I think the first area is the single market and trade. The second area is the post-pandemic recovery and the whole debate on strategic autonomy. The third area is the relationship between member states and China. And the fourth is foreign policy. Now, let me try to do this briefly. On the single market, be it because of forced securitization of the economics agenda, thanks to Trump, Europeans are increasingly concerned about the coupling of security issues and economic issues with respect to Chinese investments. And what is happening, and we've seen this with Brexit, the EU is actually very strong when it comes to protecting its single market. It has teeth. And what we're seeing is that there's a growing set of proposals on investment screening, on public procurement, and all these will be difficult for China to deal with, because it's beginning to, Europeans are beginning to raise some barriers to certain kinds of investments in Europe. And this is going to continue. It's not going to come to an end, because it's about the integrity of the single market. It's not just about the relationship between the EU and China, and it's not just about transatlantic relations. Second area I'm calling it post-pandemic recovery. Let's put it all in one basket. But shall we say the pandemic has accelerated a set of debates in the EU about its economic recovery, about its economic future, about supply chains, about its industrial strategy, the type of dependencies it has, and also raw materials, given that we're moving into an area in which the EU and China are committed to transforming the economy in a digital and green direction. In carrying out these, if you look at the exercises that have been carried out in order to design a new industrial strategy or in order to design supply chains, EU member states and EU institutions are looking critically at those areas where there are several dependencies with China. So we're actually in the areas where the EU has competences, we're moving in a direction where the game is going to get a little bit harder. On trade as well, the EU and some member states are passing legislation making private companies responsible for the human rights and labor standards in their own supply chains and in their own networks abroad. Again, this will have an impact. So while we look at the comprehensive agreement on investments that was signed in December, and then we look at the sanctions 2 months later, the sanctions issued against several individuals and one entity. And we see a contradiction. On the one hand, you see the EU wanting to do business. On the other hand, you see the EU, concerned about human rights issues. These two strands coexist because of public opinion, but also because of the way in which the European economy is investing in its future post-pandemic, post-Trump, and in the context of geopolitical rivalry. Then if we look at this other third layer, which is the relationship between China and member states, and we know that this has seen a huge expansion in the past decade or so, Chinese investments have been very helpful to some of the countries, especially during the Eurozone crisis, that were very hard hit, both by the crisis, but also by the measures that Brussels put in place, the austerity measures. And so we know that there's several countries on Europe's periphery that have been quite open to Chinese economic investments in infrastructure and all sorts of issues. But these countries, or at least some of them, are also strategically dependent on the US as far as security is concerned. So their strategic dilemma changes the moment in which the moment in which the transatlantic relationship gets a little bit better. And here we see a very mixed picture. And then, of course, we have Germany, which has, a great exporter to China, which has a different set of interests by comparison to, say, Greece, which is a net, which is a country that has accepted a lot of investments from China. So there's a lot of nuance among the member states that makes it difficult to forge a common policy. So we have single market where the EU is strong, post-pandemic recovery where the EU is making huge investments. These are complicated for China. Member state relations with China, nuanced picture, hard for the EU to forge a common policy. And then we have foreign policy, diplomacy. And here, the EU, I think, has pretty strong instinct towards dialogue, wants to keep channels open. It feels that overall, it tries to do this also with other countries. It's tried to seek dialogue with Russia without much success recently. But I think that door will be potentially open. But of course, human rights issues will continue to stand in the way. One area where dialogue is greatly encouraged, and I think it's not just in the EU, but also in the US, is on climate issues and recognition that things need to be done together. So this is the picture. It's a fragmented picture on the EU side, but I think there are some issues, and I mentioned single market and post-pandemic recovery, where the logic driving EU action is not just tied to geopolitical rivalry and the US. There is an internal logic, which is a logic about seeking a new role, seeking new sources to support the economic recovery in a green and digital direction. This logic is deeply European and will have consequences on the relationship with China.
Thank you, Rosa. Dr. Tsui, talked about the strategic document that was published in 2019, called it a a partnership, competition, and rivalry, which China has a hard time accepting. And you've just laid that out, I think, very well in a comprehensive way, that there are elements where China wants to partner with, or the EU wants to partner with China. There are elements where the EU will compete with China, and there are elements where it is much, there's a greater friction, more rivalry. I'm getting a lot of questions from the audience about the comprehensive agreement on investment. And I think people want to know what's going to happen. As I mentioned in December, the EU, the European Commission and China agreed in principle to a large scale investment agreement, which would have significantly relaxed joint venture requirements for European firms operating in several sectors in China: healthcare, automobile manufacturing, financial services. The agreement was seen as a major milestone in EU-China relations and was set to facilitate greater amounts of trade investment between the two regions. A lot of questions coming in about, you know, what lies ahead for the CAI, and is it possible to salvage the deal? And for that, maybe I'll turn to Dr. Tsui, and I'd be interested in your perspective, and then I'll turn to Rosa.
Okay, thank you. regarding to this issue about the CAI, as you know, from our European colleagues, they always call this a CAI. But as you know, from Chinese, especially from Chinese language pronunciation, we call this a CAI. CAI means dish. So it's a very interesting question: is which dish? Which dish for who? I think now, because of, as we know, this problem of the human rights issue, now the CAI has been stopped in European Parliament, and I think from China's perspective, still I think China will try to push it forward, and because I think China regarded it as a, promise with each other, between China and the European Union. And also it gives, a big meaning for China to continue its opening up and reform process. So it's very important for China to have this tie. But regarding to this, if we take some, view on short-term, mid-term, or long-term benefits for both the sides. Certainly, for European side, it will get most of short-term benefits because the CAI means opening a lot of markets and also sectors for investors from European countries. So now I think it gives a very bigger question for European side, especially this, interaction between the European Parliament and other European Union institutions, and even between European Union institutions and the member states, and also between the business circle and some politicians. So I think now the ball in the court of the European side. But of course, now I think China also try to have some more positive, attitude towards this, CAI. If we look at what happened recently, the President Xi had a call conversation with some, telephone call conversation with some European leaders. And also recently, several foreign ministers of European countries visited China. They try to have a message, not only, to European people, and also, I think, for European Union institutions, that both two sides need the CAI. So I think now, perhaps, maybe next year, we can look forward to some, positive change, of especially for the environment. I don't think that if just for the reason of European Parliament, the CAI has been stopped. Finally, I don't think it's a good case for European side to have its own strategic autonomy and to have a more, sustainable cooperation with China in economic and trade. If we look at the recent data, statistic of the bilateral trade and the investment, a lot of, increase from, this January and to April, even more than 70%, increase of investment from European country to China. So once there is not a CAI, I don't know how could the European side to keep this trend of the, bilateral trade and investment increase.
Dr. Cui, we've got a couple questions coming in for you on this particular issue. One question, this was one of the first high profile examples of China issuing retaliatory sanctions against the EU. And I'm talking now about the response to the EU, UK, US sanctions that have really put the CAI in a difficult position. Many were surprised China went as far to sanction private citizens affiliated with NGOs. Question is, are you concerned Chinese actions may be alienating partners in Europe? And also from Mater Thomas, why did Beijing escalate sanctions by targeting individual China experts in the EU? Isn't that a self-defeating move? So a couple questions on the sanctions for you.
Thank you for all of these questions. And I think they are very important questions to help us to understand what's your stand for Chinese government to have this retaliation on the, against the sanctions from the European side. I think if we look at these reactions from the Chinese side, China tried to deliver the message to European Union side is China don't want to have a kind of, a long time exchange of sanctions and counter sanctions in human rights area. Maybe China tried to give a message to European side is we should stop here. Because I think that according to the understanding from China side about the human rights, always China don't think that not only European side and also United States should not be, play the role of teaching China what's human rights and how to improve human rights like that. And secondly, I think that China tried to, give the message to European side is, because as we know, in this human rights area, China, the European Union, and China, some other member states of the European Union, they do have a human rights dialogue. Even there are a lot of complaints from European side that it doesn't work and no effect for this dialogue. But China still try to insist that the dialogue should be the single right approach for both China and the EU to touch the issue of human rights, not a sanction itself. And maybe third is, because as we know, this global human rights sanction regime issued by European Union side last December. At that time, namely that this regime will target Russia. So I don't think that China regard itself as the same like Russia. So I think it's a little bit out of the expectation from China that yes, you have this sanction against Russia, but then you have the sanction against me. So I think that for China that to have this reaction would be understandable for itself. Well, regarding to this scale of this counter sanction, I think you can find that China also tried to give a message through this counter sanction is China, just like I mentioned, China tried to say stop here. Because if you look at the list of this counter sanction from the Chinese side, not only some institution or personal who be related to Xinjiang issue, and also with almost every issue related to Chinese, domestic affairs, including Tibet, Taiwan, or even Hong Kong, some other. So I think it shows that China tried to, in China recently, there is a very popular, sentence to describe this situation. How could China to deal with the issues with other countries is, once you don't want to have some more, strike, you should have a heavier strike than somebody else. I think that should a very, very interesting, mindset of China to deal with this issue. But of course, now I think that for China and the EU, because it's just the first time, especially in the background of human rights sanction regime issued by European Union. But now I think because of the first time, first round, maybe for the future, both sides should get some, a kind of a consensus, how to deal with this sanction and the counter-sanction issues. Because anyway, according to my understanding, the most important thing for China and EU is we need to avoid some more uncertainties in these bilateral relations.
Thank you, Dr. Cui. Rosa, a lot there to respond to, but also the original question about the Comprehensive Agreement for Investment, the CAI, what's in store, and is it possible to salvage the deal? It seems like a key example of what you've been describing, the balance that the EU is trying to reach. You've got the European business community very much in favor of ratifying the CAI, yet the EU Parliament voted overwhelmingly to freeze the deal. And there, obviously, the balance between economic interests and upholding European values there is very much at play.
Yeah, I have to say, I agree very much that with the idea that the EU and China, they surprised each other with the sanctions. I think China was not expecting them from the EU, and the EU certainly was not expecting that retaliation, and that especially at that level. And insofar as those Chinese sanctions will be in place, the debate is not going to take place in the European Parliament. That's clear. China would need to climb back on the scale of sanctions in order for that debate to take place. However, were that to happen, which means that the ball is actually in Beijing's court rather than in the EU's court in this particular case, which means if that were to happen, and if those who have been the strongest advocates of the comprehensive agreement in the first instance were to persuade other elements of the EU institutional and EU member states, the sort of setup, it is possible that the CAI does resurface. Technically, the European Parliament, because of the nature of the agreement, doesn't have to go through a full ratification. It's more assent. So what's being frozen is the debate on the Comprehensive Agreement on Investments. And that it will continue to be the case for the whole of 2021. 2022, things could change. However, in the meantime, we also have elections in Germany. And at the moment, the Green Party is polling quite well. And the Green Party has a long-standing foreign policy, which is embedded in human rights support, and which is much more critical of China than the foreign policies of the current parties in the coalition. And the debate in Germany itself is changing. Even the German industrial sector is beginning to be critical of human rights standards in China, of labor standards, and also of the nature of the dependencies with China. So these things are actually shifting. And I do see that the tide is going against seamless business relations between the EU and China on human rights grounds, on grounds of insufficient reciprocity, which is something the business communities in the EU have always not appreciated, and on the grounds of public opinion, perhaps because of the coronavirus pandemic, perhaps because of an increased investment on international diplomacy on part of China, Europeans are somewhat more aware and they're not always appreciative of what we call the warrior wolf diplomacy. So things are changing somewhat. which I think make it difficult for the comprehensive agreement on investments to come back, at least in the formulation that we've seen so far. The other thing is not to forget, the studies that have been coming out show that the comprehensive agreement on investments would indeed benefit a handful of businesses located mostly in Germany, which means that you need to get, you know, the consensus also of the other member states, of other sectors. So I think it's going to be slightly harder, but technically it is possible. It's going to be slightly harder to go back to the CAI, but technically it is possible because Parliament actually does not need to ratify the deal. It's just a question of assent. So certain at the moment, it has frozen the debate, which means that there's no, it's not scheduled in the legislative, the plans of the European Parliament. They haven't scheduled it. It won't be, if at all, at the end of 2021. But technically, it is possible to resuscitate it. But politically, the conditions don't seem to be there.
Thank you, Rosa. We've got just a few minutes left, and you know, we've talked about the European Strategic Outlook, published by the European Commission in 2019, and the aspect of systemic rival. And this is, you know, we've got a couple years on now with this, but there's a perception in the EU we can take from that China is promoting alternative models of governance. Chinese officials, on the other hand, say, you know, China does not promote its values or political principles in the international system. So a couple questions, one for Rosa. In what areas does the EU consider China to be a, you know, quote unquote, systemic rival? Human rights, technology standards, economic governance, are there other aspects? And does the label relate more to China's international system of governance? Or its promotion of an alternative model of global governance? And have views in the EU changed at all since the release 2 years ago of the strategic outlook? And then I'll turn to Dr. Cui after that. First over to you, Rosa.
Yeah, I do think it's gradual, it's a patchwork change, but I do think views are changing. And I would add to the areas that you looked at, global governance. I mean, you know, WHO, and now that Biden has suggested that there ought to be another investigation into the origin of the coronavirus, all these really bring about a lot of distrust of China's role in multilateral institutions. And I think also what China's doing in Asia. And I think from the European perspective, Europe has, and it's not new, has been very concerned about maritime routes, the security of maritime routes. And I think this is another area where we'll see the EU double down commensurately with its resources, its military and naval resources. But it will be making commitments because that is, again, about securing supply chains. It's about predictability of trade, and it refers to all those areas that I mentioned at the beginning, you know, single market, trade. This is where the EU is strong, and it's prepared to pull out its claws to defend those assets. So I would add that to it. I think on the global governance dimension, that is very tricky, because the EU is by nature and through its DNA is multilateral. And its ultimate goal for its own survival really is to protect the multilateral system. And I think at the moment, the US is an ally in this, but the US has not always been an ally in supporting the multilateral system, number one. Number two, some of the problems of the multilateral system stem from the fact that it's been hegemonically Western driven. So how to embrace, include, diversify different voices whilst respecting the rules of the game? And we're seeing that these days, not all are respecting the rules of the game. We're also seeing that some are saying, well, actually, you West haven't been respecting the rules of the game, so why should we? So I think this is actually where some dilemmas really might close in at some point for Europeans, but also for the transatlantic relationship.
Thank you very much. Dr. Cui, you're going to get the last word this morning here as we're running up on our time. How does China view the EU's characterization of China as a systemic rival? And do you think China's vision of global governance, how is it different from that of the EU or other countries in the West, in the broader West? And, you know, is it manageable here between the between China and the EU? Can the two sides manage their differences over global governance issues?
I think maybe from my perspective on this issue of the European side regarding China's systemic rival, I think partly it's a kind of an emotional reaction from a European side. Because as we know, recent years, gradually more and more European countries or leaders regarded themselves as the loser of the so-called globalization. Also at the same time, to think China is a winner of the globalization. So how could find out it's a zero-sum game between winner and the loser? So always European side try to find out some systemical factors from China to prove that the loss of European is not its own fault. It's because of, a kind of unfair competition from China. And then they're trying to find out a systemic reason to find out some more difference between systems, between China and Europe, countries like that. And of course, as I think secondly, perspective from the European side on China is always a kind of less and less self-confidence from European side and more self-confidence from China. We can find a very, interesting change of this self-esteem from both two sides. It also gives us some stimulation to European side to find out more problems or challenges from China. Of course, now regarding to this cooperation between China and the EU on global governance, like you mentioned, that I think still both sides insist that global governance and to have some more multilateral cooperation to uphold this multilateralism would be bigger or major cooperation areas for both sides. So I hope that especially this year, the second half of this year, this cooperation between China, US and the European Union on climate change would be, and also I think a positive, area. Otherwise, perhaps, not only for China and the European Union, not only for China and the US, maybe for the international community, we will lose the hope for some more cooperation between big players.
Well, Dr. Cui, thank you. I suspect Rosa would have a lot to say in response to that, but unfortunately we are up on our time. Perhaps we can have a whole different session on global governance issues because seems like there's a lot of threads there to pull. But I want to thank both of you for your time this morning. And I thought it was a very rich discussion. And I appreciate your candor your comprehensive way of addressing these issues. And hope to have you back in person maybe next year, live, face-to-face for our next Carnegie Global Dialogue, China-EU. But thank you very much for joining us this year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the China in the World podcast. For more episodes and research, please go to carnegiechinghua.org. This episode was produced by Lucas Cheyenne with assistance from Madison Reed, Luke Incarnation, Li Chi Shu, John Ferguson, and Sophia Rosso.